Well, it's that time of year again. School's out and it's time for things like hurricanes and vacation Bible camp. I wish those were the only things afflicting us this week, but we're going to try and stand things on their head with joy. I invite you to turn to the insert in your order of service where you'll find a song that you might have learned at a vacation Bible camp or maybe in a Sunday school, depending on your upbringing. Raise your hands if you did. Do you know this song? We have a few victims of vacation Bible camp here. Are you ready to sing?
Yeah.
The reading is actually our song. So those who sing, who know it, you need to sing really loud so that those who don't know it are holding along. And there's a clap in it, which is indicate where you see the word clap. Okay? So, you want to start us off? Well, play it through one time first. There are only three things that I remember from my years of being forced to go to Presbyterian Sunday school. One was a scratchy little wool suit with scratchy little pants and a little bow tie clipped to a shirt that had to be buttoned all the way to the top, winter or summer, but always hot in that basement classroom next to the furnace. The second thing that I remember was a story from the book of Daniel about people being thrown alive into a burning, fiery furnace. Great reading for children, I'm thinking. But it fit my experience of Sunday school to a T. The third is that goofy little song about Noah and his ark. The Lord said to Noah, there's gonna be a floody, floody. Lord said to Noah, gonna be a floody, floody. Get my children out of the muddy, muddy children of the Lord. It's such a bouncy little number. Even today, if I remember it while I'm walking, I start to sort of skip and bobble up and down. You don't have to know that I learned it almost 60 years ago to be certain that it was composed pre-Hurricane Katrina. It's hard to imagine anyone writing such a children's song today. Get my children out of the muddy, muddy children of the Lord. I'm sure that the kids in my Sunday school class imagined that we were helping to sing all children out of the muddy, muddy, no matter what the Bible story said. No child could really be left in sweltering heat and stink without food or water. You could drink worse than a furnace in many ways, or at least God, or at least the grown-ups that we trusted would never let that happen. Even though we sang in a Calvinist church, like all little kids, we were natural universalists. We didn't understand yet that some children were less valued than others, that they were consigned, along with their parents, to be left off the boat, consigned to that fate by the powers and structures of evil, as our UU sources put it. Bad habits of indifference and neglect, bad habits that are written into law and policies, bad habits and bad ideas about some folks being less worthy than others due to the colors of their skin, the patterns of their speech, the emptiness of their pockets, or who they happen to love. We sang out a Lord and a Noah and an ark for everybody, not just for some. Small children are like that. It's amazing. The Lord said to Noah, there's going to be a floody, floody, but he didn't say why, or at least not exactly, or at least not directly to Noah. His first words to Noah were these from the Bible. I have determined to make an end to all flesh, for the earth is filled with violence to them. Behold, I will destroy them with the earth. God doesn't tell Noah who's them, but the chapter begins by setting the scene, not for Noah, but for us, the readers, the audience, the witnesses. When men began to multiply on the face of the ground and daughters were born to them, the sons of the gods saw the daughters of men were fair, and they took to wife such of them as they chose. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, when the sons of God came in to the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. These were the mighty men that were of old, men of renown. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thought of his heart was only evil continually. What a sentence. And it's kind of like that in Hebrew, too. Only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he made man on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. So the Lord said, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the ground, man and beast and creeping things and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made him. Is there anything weird in this passage that caught your attention? I thought I wouldn't need to coax you. Who are these sons of God? The Hebrew can also read as sons of the gods, who we find suddenly mating with human females. We don't know. The Bible doesn't say any more except to tell us that these were not sterile unions. There were offspring, human-divine hybrids, you could call them. Or you could call them Nephilim, as the Bible does, a name that comes from a word that means to fall. Some rabbis tell extra-biblical legends called the Agadah, explaining that their sires were fallen angels, not sons of God. King James Version calls them giants in the earth. So you get the title of the Steinhardt book. Giants in the earth. Whoever they were, they must have been really something, even as infants. Legend tells us that they were born painlessly after just a few days of pregnancy. And then they hit the ground walking and talking already. After being born at night, one ran off to find a torch so he could help his mother cut his umbilical cord. It was a long cord and a long search. On his way back, he was accosted by the chief of all demons, so the two set to fight him. This kid's still attached, right? The fight went on until a cock crowed at the approaching dawn, and the demon fled while shouting a taunt. Tell your mother that if the cock hadn't crowed, I would have killed you. So the baby replied, oh yeah? You go tell your mommy that if it hadn't been for my navel string, I would have killed you. Some tough babies, these Nephilim. Their children became extraordinary adults as well, mighty men of old, the men of renown, or as the Hebrew says literally, the people of the name, with 120-year life expectancies. Anthropologists tell us that many people who lived by hunting and gathering before turning to agriculture, like the Hebrews practiced, had the physiques of Olympic athletes. So maybe the Bible is expressing some nostalgia for these people of the name. But now hear how the next verse drags this name through the mighty mighty. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. We hear nothing about what they've done, only that there's something wrong about how they feel, think, and imagine. Everything is only evil continually. They have bad thoughts. That goes not only for the Nephilim, but for the rest of us too. It's not only the wrongdoers who must be destroyed. The passage seems a bit mixed up. Is it the giants who are the problem, this hybrid of human and divine? Or is it the ordinary folks, too? Or does it go even further than people? And God saw the earth, and behold, it was corrupt. For all flesh had corrupted their way upon the earth. And God said to Noah, I have determined to make an end of all flesh, for the earth is filled with violence to them. Behold, I will destroy them along with the earth. So the surface explanation is that the problem is corruption and violence. Not necessarily specific violent acts, but a violent nature. It goes deeper than imaginations or intentions. It goes to living flesh itself. Or perhaps the two are one. And the problem is that this flesh is imagining flesh. Even the animals are affected, and they'll have to go too when the time comes. God is sorry he made any of us. Well, look at a cat's or dog's paws twitching as they sleep and dream. Who knows what violence they might be imagining, especially the cats. I'm sorry that I made them. God is sorry, grieving over his own involvement in creation and over the very nature of what he's made. It's just too much for him for now. Maybe the problem is that he's just not used to his creation yet. It takes a while. His creation, imagining flesh, a bizarre concoction of divine and animal, human nature. I can imagine a child, an ordinary human child, one of those little knee-high giants of the spirit, saying, chill up, God. Smile. Don't be so sorry. Maybe you should go play with a friend. Maybe that's exactly what God needs, a friend from among these fleshy beings. Well, here's the here he comes now. Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his generation. Noah walked with God. While he was not one of the giants, those Nephilim who could kill demons while still attached to mom, Noah was nonetheless quite a baby himself. He glowed at birth with a bright light that filled the house. And instead of wailing, the first sound from his lips were praises to God. What were they, I wonder? Maybe they were, rise and shine and give God the glory, glory, rise and shine and give God the glory. According to the extra-biblical legends, Noah was born already circumcised. Lucky guy. Especially in those days of flint-bladed knives. Who knows, maybe being spared such pain as an infant helped him to become so cheerful and radiant. Noah's flesh, in other words, is imagined as needing no improvements. His was not violent flesh, nor perhaps even very imaginative. In fact, the Bible tells us that Noah was a slow starter, but vigorous once he got down to business. 500 years old when he begot his sons Shem, Ham, and Japheth, but beget them he did. So now, God has his friend, Noah, who walks with God while God does the talking for both. He seems ready to do whatever God says, to let God do all the imagining and never ask for a turn himself. God imagines an ark and provides the plans. Noah is happy to do the actual building. God specifies the type of wood, the dimensions, cubit by cubit, which animals to take, 7 pairs of the clean ones and 1 pair each of the animals he calls unclean. So I guess he doesn't want to destroy all species, just most of the individuals. I guess we should feel lucky. But what a relief! Maybe he's not really as angry as he seemed before. Lucky for us. So, the animals, they came in by twosie twosies. Animals, they came in by twosie twosies. Elephants and kangaroos. Children of the Lord. Whether the animals were considered to be clean or unclean by nature, it must have been a mess in the boat. It's not hard to imagine all that living, breathing, eating, drinking flesh would produce. Picture book versions of Noah's Ark often depict something like a suburban household. Each pair of creatures has their own tidy room, they're cheerful and well-behaved. Creation, digestion, sexuality, and reproduction are just put on hold for 40 days and nights of rain, and then 150 days more until the waters begin to subside. I think our little song probably tells this story more accurately. Rained and poured for 40 daisy daisies, drove old Noah, almost crazy, crazy children of the Lord. But my question for you today is just who in this story sounds almost crazy, crazy to you? Noah? The Nephilim? Those giants in the earth sprung from cosmic and earthly sources? Or rather, isn't it God who seems more than a bit off balance? Maybe that's how God really is, which might help to explain so many who have set themselves up as his representatives on earth. You might remember how even as the waters were still rising in New Orleans a few years ago, a number of our loudest religious voices were proclaiming that Katrina and the flood that followed were signs of God's anger at the lifestyles for which the Big Easy was so famous. Bad flesh, bad creatures, imagining only evil continually. Such preachers and their ilk had established their influence in the gleaming white city of Washington, D.C. at that time. And we have to wonder how much this may have influenced the administration's first response. Maybe God is as angry, resentful, and vicious as those holy first responders seem to be. After Katrina, they seemed more hostile than ever to the victims. And they haven't gone away. You've heard about some of the responses in some evangelical and fundamentalist circles this last week. But after the Bible's flood, the Bible's God seems to have gotten something out of his system. Once there's dry ground where he can walk with his friend again, he makes a promise. The book prepares us for it with one beautiful image after another. Noah sends out first a raven to see if the waters are receding. Good thing we still have ravens. Then he sends out a dove, which returns with an empty beak. He waits 7 days to send her out again, and this time she returns with an olive branch, a sign that earth is returning to life and a symbol of peace ever since. Good thing that we have doves and olives. When he sends her a third time, she does not return because she's gotten on with her life, presumably getting it on with other doves. Good thing we have places to go and wings of spirit to take us there. At last, God makes a promise to Noah and to all living creatures that he will never behave like this again. He sends forth the people and animals to once more be fruitful and multiply, as he did in the first chapter of the Bible. Nothing is wrong with their flesh now, or their imaginations. As a further sign of peace, he set his bow upon the clouds, with its curved arc turned away from the earth. When it rains again, no matter how frightened we may be, we'll be able to look at the clouds and know when we see it that things will be all right. And God will look at it too. Here's the Bible again. I will remember my covenant which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh, and the water shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. When the bow is in the clouds, I will look upon it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is upon the earth. This is the rainbow promise. Whatever was wrong before, now we are accepted. Maybe the problem never really lay in our flesh or our imaginations, but rather in the imaginations behind this part of the Bible. Maybe they or someone they knew was disgusted with all flesh, all persons, all creation, maybe most of all with himself, with his own imagination. The stuff in his head is so unacceptable, he thinks it must be someone else's stuff. Everybody else's. Here's a sorry, sorry soul who imagines what he would do to the world if he or she were God. The sorry, sorry God they think they'd be until they learn to think better. Maybe after some good teaching or a long walk with a friend. Maybe after a good cry. It's so much better to work out your rage in a flood of tears instead of a hail of bullets or a storm of explosions. Who can say that they have never felt such disgust or desperation? Life hurts or disappoints us all at times. Black clouds can fill us almost full until somehow, through luck or love or learning, they release those rainbow colors held so deep inside. A dove flies freely through the clouds, the raging tide goes calm. Our third religious principle is acceptance of one another and encouragement of spiritual growth in our congregations. Acceptance and encouragement. It's so bright and sunny that it can sound almost childlike. So be it. May this childlike, universalist spirit spread around the world like rain and flowing water to quench the fires of hate-filled rage. May it lift all boats, and may the winds of our singing help to fill the sails, even if the song is silly. Even if it's as silly as this one that sings how the sun came up and dried up the landy, landy sun came up, dried up the landy, landy, everything was fine and dandy, dandy, children of the Lord. Fine and dandy, fine, dandy, dandy, for all of us kids, no matter how big or small or where our stripe fits in this great, good rainbow. So, let me be.